The Alan Clarkson Weekly Review, Current Technology Analysis, Show Number 34, June 10th and 11th, 2006, wvtexan.podomatic.com. This week's intro music is available on the PodSafe Music Network at music.podshow.com. The artist is the Alice Project, and the track, Ready to Play. In this week's show, we look at the changeable web and Java server faces, the buzz is robotic worms, a legal case involving electronic discovery, and for the Because You Can site, cryptography. Those of you listening on an iPod and downloading through iTunes can now click the center button of your iPod for the summary of each week's show, as well as seeing my picture associated with the podcast. Dudes, we are moving forward. But on with the show. The changeable web and Java server faces. If the changeable web is about user experience, it is. And if user experience is largely about the interface to data, it is. And if development of future applications will require configurable user interfaces, it will. Then Java server faces may provide part of the answer. In previous episodes of this show, we've looked at the combination of XML and JavaScript to provide user interaction in web pages. We've looked also at some of the various platforms that help developers create those interfaces, including Ruby on Rails and JavaScript library toolkits. This week, another development platform and tool to quickly assemble these responsive user interfaces, Java Server Faces. Sun Microsystems originally envisioned Java as a universal platform for application development. In theory, a program developed in Java could be run in the same manner on a Windows machine, Macintosh machine, or Linux machine, assuming that the Java runtime is in place. The web has largely replaced this model of cross-platform functionality. Browser-based interactivity with data sources is quickly moving from flashy new technology to expected and accepted practice for entire business plans. However, with the relative simplicity of the theory, the practice of developing interactive user interfaces using JavaScript and XML is not easy. I should note here, to avoid confusion, that Java and JavaScript are not the same thing. Java is a programming language that requires a runtime to compile and execute. JavaScript is a scripting language that executes within the application context of a web browser. The two are related in name only. JavaScript is officially recognized by the Internet Engineering Task Force and World Wide Web Consortium as ECMA script, or ECMAScript, anyway. Okay, Java Server Faces. The Java platform includes a technology for developing dynamic web pages called, blandly enough, Java Server Pages, or JSP. JSP connects data sources to user presentation by querying a database, say, and assembling a catalog page for a website. For the sake of this discussion, JSP is similar to Microsoft's Active Server Pages, ASP, or the open source PHP language. Not the same thing, but similar. Java Server Faces is a set of tools and an integrated development environment for building client-side interactivity for JSP applications. The faces part comes from the fact that this technology is designed to build user interfaces for web applications. JSF differs from other web application client-side interactivity techniques in that instead of using XML and ECMAScript, JSF uses Java Web Controls and Java Beans technologies to execute user requests and store application state data. JSF requires a Java Server Pages infrastructure. You've got to have the backend in place. This is not open source free access technology. What it is, however, is another example of the transfer of processing from the server side of browser-based applications to the client side, leveraging ever more powerful client computers to make the browser and the internet an increasingly attractive application delivery platform. More browser-based interactivity is good for the changeable web. The interactivity brings users to the browser platform. The tools to ease development bring application designers to the platform. More developers and users on the platform brings the notion of interactivity and eventually user experience, and one hopes configurability, to the mainstream. See the show notes for links to several articles discussing the Java Server Faces technology. The buzz is robotic worms. Nanotechnology is fascinating, and the applications theoretically endless. From network-aware clothing to super-sharp video displays to waste-processing micro-robots, the fantasy potential of minuscule machines is mind-boggling. A step in that direction was announced this week in a New Scientist article discussing the development of a robotic worm by European researchers. Okay, worms are not nanotechnology, but this device is pretty darn small. The article points out that current non-surgical exploratory measures for gastrointestinal problems include camera pills and endoscopy. This device, the worm, would permit doctors to take internal exploration a step further, to include stops and starts and turnarounds and so forth, all beyond the current capabilities of camera pills and endoscopes. Researchers point out, however, that before human tests are begun, extensive additional testing is needed to make sure that worms don't get stuck in people's intestines. Now that's a comforting thought. Nanotechnology and its cousin, microrobotics, will continue to make a significant mainstream impact. The robotic gut worm may be an extreme example, but the foundational theory of developing increasingly small machines to perform tasks that are currently invasive or even destructive is an intriguing proposition. Low cost and safety are major obstacles, but only obstacles, not insurmountable barriers. The world of tomorrow, in your gut. See the show notes for a link to the New Scientist article. If you check out the article, look at the sidebar there for links to stories about robotic insects and other applications of small to nanotech. The legal case is Curto v. Medical World Communications, Incorporated. This week's legal case, an appeal from May of 2006, discusses the employer-employee relationship, particularly with regard to personal use of computers and attorney-client privilege. The plaintiff is an employee involved in a dispute with her former employer. She was issued a computer from the company to use in her work, but she worked from home. During the course of her employment, that original computer, a Mac laptop, that she had been using was replaced with a Dell laptop. Both laptops were eventually returned to the defendant, employer, during the course of this current dispute. At issue is the forensic discovery of deleted personal files from both laptops, files for which the plaintiff asserts attorney-client privilege. The appeals court, citing the district court, notes that, quote, voluntary disclosure of communications protected by attorney-client privilege generally results in a waiver, but the inadvertent production of a privileged document does not waive the privilege unless the producing party's conduct was so careless as to suggest that it was not concerned with the protection of the asserted privilege, unquote. With this in mind, the district court applied a four-factor test to these files, the recovered files, to determine whether or not the plaintiff could assert privilege on those recovered documents. The four factors are pretty standard. 1. The reasonableness of any precautions taken by the producing party to prevent inadvertent disclosure. 2. The volume of the discovery versus the extent of the specific disclosure at issue. 3. The length of time taken by the producing party to rectify the disclosure. And 4. The overarching issue of fairness. Pretty standard. But in this case, the district court added a further subfactor of interest, whether or not there was enforcement of any computer usage policy. It is this subfactor that is most at issue in the appeal, because it is this subfactor that provides the key to the plaintiff's privilege assertion. The district court found, and the appellate court upheld, that although there was a usage policy in place that prohibited personal use of employer-owned computers, and further, that the policy explicitly denied an expectation of privacy, the employer could not demonstrate a history of enforcement of this policy. In fact, the plaintiff was able to show specific instances in which the policy was not enforced, establishing a reasonable expectation that deleting her personal files from the laptop would be sufficient to establish that precautions were taken to prevent inadvertent disclosure. The courts go a step further to note that lax enforcement of an acceptable use policy creates a, quote, false sense of security, close quote, and another, quote, lulled employees into believing that the policy would not be enforced, close quote. The lesson: an acceptable use policy is not a blanket protection. To be an effective deterrent and a defensible policy, it must be applied consistently and visibly. Otherwise, it's effectively meaningless. See the show notes for a link to the published appeal, as well as an article analyzing the result. This week's Because You Can site is actually quite useful, but may represent a time commitment in order to fully enjoy it. The University of Washington in the U.S. has posted archived video and presentation slides for several courses in the Computer Science and Engineering School. Of particular interest to the focus of this podcast is a course on cryptography, delivered in the first quarter of 2006. To fully appreciate the course, you'll need to download a presentation viewer written in the Microsoft.NET platform exclusively for this course delivery system, but it's worth the installation. The course is a graduate-level seminar covering the key aspects of modern cryptography in a lecture and presentation format. Best part? Watch when you want. Worst part? The guilt you may feel if you start and don't finish. This course and others like it from the University of Washington may represent a future for education, web delivery of archived content for fun, and maybe profit. For now, it's free. See the show notes for links to the course's online archived webpage. Well, that's all for this week. Check back next week for another review. Remember, all the show notes are available at www.protopage.com/weeklyreview. And if you get a minute, leave a comment there on the posting site. It'll be nice to hear from you. We're going out now with the Alice Project from the PodSafe Music Network with Ready to Play.